Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline Kilborn, is not able to join us today, but listen next week or the week after, and I'm sure she'll be back with us. We have a really interesting book today that covers a lot of ground. It's called One Day on the Gold Line, A Memoir in Essays by Carla Sammoth. And Carla has taught creative writing to incarcerated youth through Write Girl and teaches at the Los Angeles Writing Project at California State University, Los Angeles, and with Southern New Hampshire University. Carla's writing has appeared in various anthologies and publications. She has an MFA from Queen's University in Charlotte and is a member of the Pasadena Rose Poets. Carla was selected to be a 2019 Pride Poet with the City of West Hollywood and was a 2016 Penn in the Community Teaching Artist. Carla lives in Southern California with her wife. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Carla.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, when did you start writing? Because I got the feeling from your book that although you were writing your whole life, it was maybe not writing for publication.
Yes. It's true. I was writing a lot of my life, but I didn't start writing for publication until probably after I had my son. So when I was in my mid-30s. And at some point, my son, just as I used to get up in the my mom used to get up early in the morning and I would dictate my stories and she'd type them up for me. I started doing that for my son. And I sent off a piece that he had written to the LA Times after 9/11. And they said, well, we're not writing about 9/11, but maybe you can submit something else. And so he got a short piece published. And I thought, I should start sending my own stuff out.
Yeah.
So it kind of inspired me. So little by little, you know, you start out small and think, well, you know, I'm a working single mom. If I can just get one piece published, I'll be happy. And then you keep raising the bar. And then after a while, you know, you want more. And you start, and one author who I was working with suggested that I should be writing more of a book length project versus single essays. And so that kind of planted the seed of writing a book-length memoir. But it took me, you know, quite a while. I started publishing more and more, but I really didn't go intensely into finishing the book and working on the book until after my son left home and I went off to get my MFA kind of a little bit later in life.
What made you decide to do that?
You know, I always, it's interesting because somewhere along the line I found those old PSAT things that said that I wanted to study creative writing. But when I went to college, I was very much, I remember I wrote a story when I was like 13 of my demise as a writer because I realized I couldn't write like fiction and fantasy when the world was such a brutal place. So, I don't know what happened then, but I started, but I was more about studying social change and political economy and that kind of thing by the time. So I wrote a lot, but it wasn't so much creative writing. So when I went to my undergraduate, I was doing more of that. And over time, I sort of came back to the writing, to the creative writing. I really became interested in getting an MFA, but I didn't really see a path to it. I wanted it more than anything to be able to have it as a means to focus intensely on finishing this book. And I didn't really see myself being able to do that until my son got older. Well, I used to tease him and say, you know, when you go off to college, I'll go with you and we'll live on the dorm and we'll go to parties together. And he just did not find that funny at all. Kind of terrifying. I was really just kidding, you know.
Well, you know, I dropped out of college to have my son. And so I was a young mom, and there were times when I thought, oh, I'll go back and finish before he does, before he goes to college, or I'll go back and finish while he's in college, It just, you know, life gets in the way, and there wasn't any career purpose for me to go to college, because right. I had created the career that I wanted without it, and but still, you know, here I am. with grandchildren. And maybe I'll finish college before my grandkids do.
Oh, maybe. I've seen that done. I mean, I ended up, my son didn't go off to college when I went off to get my MFA. He went off to a young man's recovery house. You know, our paths are just really different than what we expect them to be. And, you know, he ended up starting a really successful career in costuming. You know, he's at the beginning stage of it. But he still talks about going to school eventually to, you know, for the sake of learning, you know. And for me, I kept thinking about graduate school, but it was hard to imagine again with, you know, doing, I had started my own business as well. I was working in the nonprofit world, and then I had to improve my own economic mobility. And I ended up getting recruited out during the first tech phase and tech boom. And I was doing PR, which gave me a lot of flexibility to be able, you know, I could work around the clock, but I could escape if my son was sick and be with him or go on a field trip. But I didn't see the path to going back to school. And like you, I was kind of trying to figure out what it is I want to do. But, it, you know, as the years went on, it was more and more I really want to get my MFA, and not so much because I thought it would impact me in terms of career-wise, but more so that I would have the support and focus and mentorship to finish my book.
Well, that makes sense. And obviously it worked because you did.
I did, yes.
Now, did all of the essays in this book get published elsewhere previously?
No, I mean, a number of them did, but not all of them. Many of them were published in a variety of literary magazines, and some of them were published in, like, Pasadena Weekly. But, no, there's a good number that haven't been published yet still.
The book covers from your teen years to, what, maybe 5 or 10 years ago? Something like that?
Yeah, till about, you know, you have to cut it off sometime. It's not an autobiography, you know, that famous to do that. So I guess I cut it off at about 55, 56, and I'm 60 now. And it's funny because when I'm doing readings and it references my age, and I feel like people are looking up going, you're not 55. You're 60. Yeah.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's interesting though, because the times, you know, I'm exactly the same age you are.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, you know, the different times that you're living about writing through, you know, I lived through, but at the same kind of stage in my life, but I was in the Midwest, which would be very different from being on the West Coast. So, there's some things I can totally relate to and some that not quite as much.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, I wonder, a lot of people, when they write a memoir, do write about their childhoods, which you didn't really, although I get the feeling that there was quite a lot going on there. You drop hints about it here and there, but...
No, there's not a ton. You know, a big focus of the book is where I realized that I really want to have a child, mm-hmm. and the difficult journey to having my son, and then kind of the challenges that came after that obsession or desire or myth that I believe that you could create safe sanctuary of family, and that it would be richer for my son to have a, you know, it'd make his life so much richer to have a queer mom and be Black and Jewish and be part of a blended or a single parent family. And it actually made it so much more difficult. So it's kind of about the challenges, you know, around race and identity and police violence and later his struggle with addiction. I do make reference to my childhood.
Right. Particularly
and I do
the
kind of
Sammy boy.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Which I love that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's funny you say that because I recently read in Seattle, which is where I'm from, and my fourth grade classmates were there, a number of them, as well as the fourth grade teacher. So that was 1968, right? I went back to try to figure out why was fourth grade so important. I know for me, it's when I remember being this strong, tough tomboy. And according to those classmates, adult classmates, they said I was like Arya from Game of Thrones, which I haven't watched, but I guess she's a bad, I don't know if I'm allowed to say
You're
that other
not,
word. I guess
but,
she's, okay.
but she is.
Yeah, tough tomboy. And so that was really a pivotal time. There was a lot going on in the classroom. Our neighborhood and our school was rough, and it was very diverse economically and ethnically. And I was a little bit puzzling around about my identity because a large part number of my classmates were Black or Asian, and I wasn't either. But I had a teacher that was really Mrs. Kumada into instilling ethnic pride and would tell me, "You're Jewish, you're something." And I think as the years went on at different phases in my life, when I was looking to find strength and to find that person, that tough, fearless person who played the trumpet and was willing to take on the class bully and had more belief in self, I thought back to that person. I thought, where did she go? And at some point, we moved out to Bellevue, which was a very WASPy white suburb, and we looked very different from everyone there, and our family was really different. And so, you know, I do talk a little bit about, like, I allude a little bit to childhood and how kind of what a big change that was and how different our family was from the families out in the suburbs. And I guess some of the desire that I had, this idea of family as a safe oasis and the difficulty in creating that, particularly with the people I chose to have family with. And, you know, I had a very loving family, but there was a lot of, sometimes there was happy chaos, sometimes there was just chaos. there was always a lot going on. There were certain qualities that my parents had of, you know, loyalty and valuing the family and that were really important to me. But I think I aspired to create this much calmer environment and was not entirely successful. I really wasn't successful at it. What I was successful at is ironically similar to what maybe my parents did, is a sense that my son knows that I'll always be there for him. And I think my stepdaughter as well. And God knows we're so flawed as parents. There's so many things that we aspire to do better than what our parents did, right? You know, or differently, or
right.
You know, but there's a pretty strong genetic imprint, and even historically genetic imprint that you know affects the way we live and we parent.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Carla Sammoth, author of One Day on the Gold Line, a memoir and essays. You really kind of lay all the flaws out in this book. How do you have the courage to do that? And what kind of, you know, feedback have you gotten?
Well, I think that it was really important to me to go there as far as my own flaws, because you know, I think particularly when you're writing about other people in your life, it's first important, kind of like stand up. You have to first poke fun at yourself. It's really important to have agency and to really be vulnerable. And I'm not sure exactly how I did it. They say to write as if no one is going to read what you're writing, and then edit as if everyone is. I have gotten feedback from people who said that, you know, it really spoke to them because of the vulnerability, and that it did give them a sense of strength because of, you know, some connection they felt to another flawed human being. I kind of wrote the book that I wanted to read in the sense that I was looking for other families that we did not look like a Norman Rockwell family, not my family of origin or the family I created. And I wanted to read more about people who are struggling with some of the same issues that I did. You know, when I was trying to have my son, I had many miscarriages. I had a lot of invasive treatment. I went back and forth between thinking about doing it as a single mom and doing it with someone else. And, you know, with each different piece, you know, the blended and the unblended family and the multiracial family and, you know, LGBT and all the things that we went through, as well as the struggle with addiction. There are more books that cover some of those themes, but I wasn't really finding enough And so I really felt a sense of connection when I read work by authors who went there, who did show themselves in all the ugliness and the flaws and the, you know, the joy and, you know, the despair. And I felt less alone when I read work like that. And I hope to do the same with my readers. And so, you know, the book just came out in July, so it's still early, but I am hearing from people that, you know, I'm always happy when I do a reading and people cry.
That's well, my goal. Talk about crying. Tell us a little bit about the title and where when that came from. Yeah.
Okay. So the title is in part metaphorical, but there is a title essay. And the title essay deals with a really horrific incident that happened to me. It sounds so vague to say incident, an assault by a sheriff's deputy on the metro. I don't want to give the whole story away, but I was going along starting to write an essay about things that were happening to my black son as he got a little bit older, and my fears about him being harmed, you know, by law enforcement. So we were seeing more and more situations of young black men being killed by police, and just the risk that black youth were at. So I was writing about things like, you know, I can't believe that people would cross the other side of the street from a group of my son and his friends who don't even have hair under their arms yet. And then I was the person who had this experience with the LA Sheriff's Department, who I later came to find out had a big problem with culture of violence, where they were trained in the jails and then they went out onto the metro. And so I, this happened to me, and it really at the time felt like a real bottom. It felt a long ways away from Sammy Boy.
Well, it was appalling. And the actions that they, you know, the behavior of these deputies was appalling and just almost unbelievable. I mean, I know that those things happen, but man, it's just, yeah, you really brought it home.
Well, yeah, that was my intention. And, you know, I learned a lot because I'd been on the other side. I used to work for the Seattle City Attorney's Office prosecuting domestic violence cases. I'd never been on the other side. And I learned when I went out with my family, went out and talked to civil rights attorneys, that this was a big problem with the LA Sheriff's Department. And, it was my worst fear that I had for my son. And so it was a real eye opener. And I think that sometime after this happened to me, there started to be a lot more news coverage about the LA County Sheriff's Department and the problems there. And people became more aware. But certainly when I published that essay, I had so many people come up to me. I mean, every walk of life, all different races and economic classes come up to me and say, hey, you know, this happened to me, or this happened to a friend of mine, or I didn't know that this could happen to anybody. So that kind of gave me the sense of the impact that writing about something like that could have.
Yeah. And also, it's like, how do I say this? When these things happen, you know, the Trayvon Martin, well, that wasn't police, but, you know, the Ferguson and Sandra, can't remember her last name, down in Texas. And, yes. And yeah, you know, all these people, there's always, you know, here in this, in our little mostly white area in the Midwest, there is a tendency for people to think they must have done something wrong. They must have brought it on themselves in some way. But you, as a white middle-aged woman in LA, when you tell this story, it almost, people might have a tendency to listen more because they can identify with you as the victim.
I think that's possible. You know, I heard all sorts of things. I did have one person say to me that they had a neighbor, and this person was Jewish and white, and that they had a neighbor whose cousin had been I think, killed by the police, and that he always thought, well, maybe something else happened, and that this did open up his eyes. Now, in my case, there was a, some hypothesis by my dentist or different people, like, oh, I look very Middle Eastern. Was there any kind of profiling, or was there any kind of profiling just by virtue of, I had one interviewer say to me, well, the police view people who ride on public transportation to be less than. So it's hard to say, but it definitely did bring home the idea that it was, in this case, really the LA Sheriff's Department, a department gone amok where, violence and seeing people as other, who are incarcerated or perhaps who are riding public transportation was very much a part of their culture. So, I mean, there was that response. I wrote what you're talking about, oh, maybe something else happened. I mean, I think there's always that suspicion, whatever ethnicity you are, that like, well, what really happened there? And there were people also that I think wondered about that. And, I wrote a story a while back, quite a number of years back, about an incident that happened in South Pasadena, which is a wider area south of Pasadena. And there were a group of maybe 9 black kids total who went to the high school that my son had gone to before. And he came back and told me about something that had happened after he was no longer at the school, where apparently they discovered, all the black students discovered, we're all wearing purple today. And they decided to walk through the school together. And people went running into the principal's office saying, there's a gang, maybe they were chanting Black Power. And so I wrote a story about this called Walking Together While Black in South Pasadena. Is that a problem? And I had people writing things like, well, those kids were probably up to no good, and then some people wrote who were black, they wrote, welcome to my world.
Yeah. Well, I always have a tendency to believe the stories because of some run-ins I had with officials, related to my son when he was a teenager. And it's like, well, they lied. They just lied. And I knew that they lied because I was, I was there. And so that always made me a little more skeptical than the average person, probably.
Right.
So, yeah. Carla, before we run out of time, I'd like to have you read a little bit from your memoir in essays.
Absolutely. I'm going to read a story, one of the essays, Paperweights, that comes a little bit later in the book. In a story I once wrote about my own death, I imagined my son was a writer living in Brazil. He returned to the States to go through my stuff and sift helplessly through piles and scraps of paper, my hoarded semi-legible writing from childhood through menopause. He threw up his arms. What could he do? He couldn't read most of it. Wouldn't want to if he could. In my office, I kept a tall file cabinet. All 3 drawers are filled with journals and writings dated back to my primary school years. They are also scattered throughout my house. There are notebooks of all sizes and shapes, black composition books, a few of those annoyingly common Moleskines, scraps of paper, a three-ring binder or two, museum-decorated journals, a treasure hunt for my cat who likes to chew paper. I have thought that someday I'll read these mounds of scrawled paper. I read an article written by several poets who devoted considerable time to contemplating what to do with their writing, Detrius. It described people burning or even shooting their journals while they were still alive to make that decision. One poet entrusted her son to dispose of her journals after her death, but was okay with him reading them first. Another said she decided to store them in an attic where I don't have to run into them, after her Facebook community decried her post announcing the volume's imminent destruction. I might have to destroy my past before I ever reread it. I can't seem to organize any of it. Random excursions into my filing cabinets have often sent me scurrying back to safety when I find that some of the same things cluttering my mind at age 13 still do so today. Debt, love, family, mortality, worrying. Or am I just bored with making the same mistakes and lamentations over and over again? Occasionally I find a gem worth saving, but more often than not, my search for that epiphany is fruitless. My mom kept doing crossword puzzles for a long while, even when she spent more time staring into space, but she still had more answers than I could ever get. A grammarian, a librarian, she'd corrected our speech all of our lives. Sometimes her children and caregivers try to help with the crosswords and can't read a thing she writes. Often she writes nothing, creates new words or colors so hard she puts a hole through the paper. I'm not sure what my mom thinks, or if she does, when she sits silently. I didn't grow up with silence. But sometimes I, too, could just sit staring into space, trying to understand it all. You spent years of your life trying not to get pregnant, and then, boom, you spend years trying to be pregnant. And then in no time, when you barely stopped nursing and just started sleeping through the night, it seems it's perimenopause and menopause time. You spent years trying to get away from your parents, and then you start liking them more. You always loved them. And then, boom, they are changing or changed or dead. Or they think they are your they think you are their sister or mom. You spent years longing for some time, just a little spare time for yourself away from your kids, a son and stepdaughter born 4 months apart. Then, boom, they are ready to go, don't want you around, or some positive thing might happen, like college or sports or a boyfriend or girlfriend or a job, or something horrible happens, like unblended families or drugs, and you fear you'll lose them or their love or both forever. You go to the funeral and then sit Shiva for a temple friend's son. He had hung himself, and she had found him, 22 years old. At Shiva, she hugs you and whispers, "We worry so about our boys." And you consider this a gift amid a loss you didn't and still don't believe you could live with. She knew about your son's struggles with addiction, but your son is alive. Yes, she was generous. The distance between your fears and her reality was mountainous, but not remote. And then you land womp, like in The Wizard of Oz, a tornado spun you about, your house plopped on top of a witch, and how did you get there? But all you know is that your son and stepdaughter are both 18, they both tell you they love you, and they both seem to be okay. They want to see you regularly, and it's all you can do to fit that in once or twice a week, because by then, you are really busy again with your own separate life. And in this short entry, you have summed up your entire life. Something you imagine should have taken at least a day to compose, that you finish in a blink. And that, too, is something that happened. The writing of words that are unplanned, but sometimes misspelled or otherwise humiliatingly wrong when you submitted a piece, P-E-A-C-E, instead of a piece, P-I-E-C-E. It's the dreaded homonym disorder you named in the early stages of perimenopause. Back in the day, growing up in your house, your parents taught you to be very suspicious of anyone mixing up T-O-O, T-O, and T-W-O. And 10 years ago, you asked to be taken out and shot if you ever wrote nice to M-E-A-T-U. And yet you did. The evidence is in an old email to the client who hired you. You assume he didn't see it. And all you can do now is hope that you'll finish your book before you end up like your mom, watching the same movie over and over again. Though it won't be Pride and Prejudice, most likely. Nor will it be Mr. Darcy, to whom you imagine you are married. But you might have to wear a diaper. And she doesn't really know what she's watching at all these days. And the good thing was that for a while, when you were still very busy, it didn't take much time to talk to your mom. Not like in the past, when you'd have to set aside close to an hour. After so many years of engaged, animating, and sometimes intrusive questioning, she had very little to say to you or anyone most of the time. Her mind was running out like the hourglass in The Wizard of Oz. But even today, you still don't know how long it will take. She is just placid, more accepting and inactive than she'd been all your life. And sometimes you miss her persistent interest in your well-being. And one day when you are 54 years old, you call her up and say, "Mom, I'm going back to school." She answers clearly, "Your mom again for a moment. That's good, honey. You've always been such a great writer." She ought to know. She used to get up in the wee hours to type your stories when you were too young, just as you did later for your son. She doesn't remember when you last called, but she's always happy to say hello when you do. She asks where you are and if you need her to pick you up at the airport, even though she hasn't driven anywhere for years. You tell her you are home and not coming that day, not for a while. The conversation is over in less than a minute. She is ready to hang up. And that is that. She is back to Pride and Prejudice. And you are back to your life, what is left of it. And there is an awful lot still left.
Thank you. And that was Carla Sammoth reading from One Day on the Gold Line, a memoir in essays. And we're out of time, Carla, and I still had so much I wanted to ask you. When's your next book coming out?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm working on Link short stories. I love writing other people's story. I'm a little tired of my own, so it's hard to say, but I'd love to come back and talk to you when it does.
I hope that you'll do that. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Monica.
And we will be right back with our second guest today. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley, back with you again. And our guest today is Keel Bergen, and she's the author of Wholly Unraveled, a memoir. Now, Keel is an entrepreneur, activist, mother of three, author, and filmmaker. Her story of survival and self-discovery has inspired a life dedicated to impacting tens of thousands of women across the globe. Keel made her mark in the business world by co-founding two companies, taking her first one public. Keel is the founder of, capital letter B in parentheses, a company that curates tribes of women that come together to rebuild their lives and relinquish the patterns of behavior that hold them back. So hopefully we can learn a little bit more about that. And Wholly Unraveled is a memoir of her younger years. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Keel.
Thank you so much, Monica. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, this is kind of a not a happy story. Has a kind of a happy ending, but there's a lot of really painful parts of your memoir. What made you decide that to write this and not only write it, but to publish it?
Yeah, I fundamentally, Wholly Unraveled is about overcoming adversity and healing, really, and transforming your life. And what made me do it is, you know, I've traveled the world. I do microcredit lending and I do education and vocal empowerment in other countries. And I just started to realize that I was asking all of these women to tell me their story, but I hadn't told my story yet. And so I really believe that there's a transformation that can happen when you tell your story, and especially when you tell the story you don't want to say out loud. A lot of the stories that you read in Wholly Unraveled are stories I really did not want people to know about me. But after saying them, it's like it shed this light, and it turned the trauma into something more beautiful.
Wow. By the way, I do find there is a Fairfield connection that you have, because I'm looking at the back jacket of your book, and there's a quote from Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, who lived here in Fairfield for many, many years, and whom I've known for many, many years. And she writes, Keel Bergen is a living, breathing example of the triumph of the human spirit. The story of how she overcame the extreme abuse of her childhood is nothing short of breathtaking. And it was extreme. I mean, it was hard to read. How hard was it to write?
It was excruciating to write. It took me 5 years. And what I want to say about that is that you have to be ready. You have to have had a certain level of healing. I've been doing EMDR therapy for more than 12 years. And I got to a point where I was healed enough that I could go back and write. But it was very difficult to relive those. And the way I write, is a narrative form. And so I really didn't want to save the reader. I didn't want to say, well, I'm going to be fine. Here's what happened. And so what I did was I just took the reader with me. And for me, that was a really powerful experience. But like I said, very difficult to write. I mean, I would take pictures of the young version of my father if I was writing that chapter of when he would abuse me. And I would take a picture and put it on my computer so that it was right there. And I would have to look at him as I was typing. And so it was difficult, but really important. And it was finally clear when I finished it that I had put all this blame on myself. And it was misplaced. It actually belonged to my dad. And so I was able to transfer a lot of that shame and blame and hurt and, you know, and just get it off of my plate.
You seem to be your father's primary target. Did you ever figure out why?
I wish I knew why, Monica. I have no idea. Maybe I was stubborn or I really don't know. I just know that my other sisters escaped the abuse.
Hmm. Were they aware of it?
I can't speak for them, but I can't imagine that they weren't aware of it.
Yeah.
I don't have any contact with my family on purpose, and so I don't know.
I wonder if there was some... I mean, it seemed like you were trying to hide it, and to a large extent, you did from the outside world. It would be difficult, I think, to hide it from your family. They must have known, but they may have had things going on that they were hiding too.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I think in general, I mean, I love Flannery O'Connor says, if you've walked through your childhood, you have enough material for a lifetime to write about.
Right.
So I think everyone has those stories from childhood. What I really want people to take away from Holy Unraveled is that our childhoods don't have to define us, and that, you know, it's not easy to walk through the pain, but it's worth it at the end to have a really, really happy life. I mean, I have a very full, very happy, fulfilling, love-filled life. And I want people to hear that, because the abuse and the trauma was intense, but it doesn't have to define us.
You do, in the book, you do start to heal. And part of the abuse, I don't think I'm giving too much away, had to do with... some religious extremism, and you did, but you didn't turn away from religion. You actually found some healing in the good aspect of religion. Do you want to address that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to, because it's a strange irony, and I love it about my life. But yes, I grew up in kind of a Catholic cult kind of situation. My father was one of the leaders of the cult, and, the problem was he was a narcissist, and so he was really the God, right? So like for things like I would have to pray in tongues before, or be slain in the spirit before I was allowed to leave the dinner table some nights. And women were called handmaids of the Lord, and they were, you know, there were, yeah, right?
Right.
And so I grew up in this crazy, like women didn't have a voice kind of scenario, but... And when I left that, I chased adrenaline for a long time, drugs, alcohol, very poor decisions. And then when I finally kind of woke myself up, I landed and hitchhiked to a remote Ontario, Canada, in the middle of nowhere, no indoor plumbing, no electricity. You know, we used root cellars, and I lived with 150 people in a Catholic community that was highly structured and silent. And that's where I started my healing, which is just so ironic. Because
It is. Like, what drew you there?
What drew me there was there's an archbishop, his name, I'm so grateful for him. His name is Archbishop Joseph Raya, and he was the Archbishop of Galilee. And he came to visit my family for a summer in New Jersey when I was little. And he was the only priest I ever had a connection with who treated me like really beautifully. Like I didn't have a lot of connection with a lot of priests growing up. So it wasn't that they were bad. It was just this particular one. He would take me for a walk on the boardwalk. He would ask my opinion. He would talk about Marilyn Monroe. He gave me communion earlier than I was supposed to have it. Like he just broke the rules a little bit, you know? And I remembered him saying to me, all there is love. It was just love. And he lived in that place, Madonna House in Canada, for summers. And I remembered that. And when I was at my lowest point, I had woken up. I was evicted from another apartment. I had lost another car. I had done too many drugs the night before. And I remembered his voice. And so I hitchhiked there. And I lived there for a year in silence.
Wow. Now, it wasn't all roses there either, though.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No. No, it was incredibly difficult because when I got quiet, when I wasn't trying to fill this void with, you know, alcohol, drugs, anything, it got really loud and I had to really face what happened to me in my childhood. Hmm. And the really incredible part for me is there was this woman there, her name is Marion, and she was so beautifully holy, if that makes sense. She had these piercing blue eyes. She could read your heart. You could feel her when she walked in the room. She was just very, very close to God. And she was the leader of the community. And, well, maybe I should read. Can I read a little piece about that? Yeah,
sure.
I can set it up that this is at Madonna House, in a dining room full of 150 people. You could talk during meals. That was it. And she comes into the room and I'll take it from there. Marion came out of the kitchen dressed in a red sweater and black pants and walked to the table, her table. She looked like she had seen a ghost and beat the shit out of it. She was pale with red blotches on her face and neck, and both of her hands were tightly balled into fists that I could see, and I could see the whites of her knuckles. Her signature quiet glide across the floor had been traded for an angry pounding of determined steps. She passed behind me and took her usual seat at the head of the table across from Jeremy, who had just returned from the kitchen with our food. Marion's eyes were glued to the air 6 inches above her. Her lashes stuck to the skin above her eyes, and her mouth was set between a straight line and a frown. The silence had a foul scent. The air was thick and wet. It made my nose crinkle and my eyes burn. I looked around the room, and it was as if she had petrified it. She put both of her fists on the table. Her white hair was prickly and standing on end as if she had just pulled her finger out of a socket. But she was staring far away from here. Her red sweater was disheveled and the white turtleneck under it tight against her neck, standing at attention. She stood up and the dining room shook. I heard a glass break somewhere in the distance, but I couldn't take my eyes off Marion. "I hate you, God," she screamed. Her arms were extended in front of her, one held higher than the other, like a boxer in a ring, and the red blotches on her face were spreading. "In 23 years, I have asked you for exactly one thing. One. I had a plan for my life, and I gave that up because you asked me to. One thing I asked you for, one thing. Protect him." Her voice ricocheted off the walls. "To protect him." Her head was raised to the heavens, and I could see embers of hatred fanning the fire in her eyes. She looked up and her fists followed. "Do you hear me?" I couldn't take a breath. There was no oxygen in the room. She willed the sun behind a cloud and the light in the room darkened. "Did you bother to whisper in his ear when he was buying the gun? Were you at least with him when he pulled the trigger and bled to death in his apartment alone? You didn't stop him. You weren't even there, were you?" Her voice was shrill and her eyes were shattered. "You broke our promise and I will not forgive you." She shifted her weight to the right side of her body, put one hand on the table and looked down. "You abandoned me. How can you call yourself a merciful God when you stood by and watched Brad in so much pain that suicide was the only answer? Where is your end of the bargain? I kept mine. I have been living my promise every day. In every duty of the moment that you asked of me, I gave my yes, God's will. Ha! All these years, I have surrendered to that notion, and now I'm a pawn in your big lie." I tried to stuff my head into my shoulders, waiting for the impact. I stared at her, and I felt power. Red, hot, holy power. She was dancing with the divine, and she looked unafraid. She was upright with her chest thrust out and her legs firmly rooted on the floor. She wasn't bracing for impact. She was delivering it.
Did this change things for you?
It did. I finally figured out that my dad wasn't God in that. Mm. And that I know that she didn't hate God, but the the ability that she was having a real dialogue with her divine was so amazing to me that I realized that God is love and God is merciful, and God is a relationship, not something to just be afraid of, but there's mercy.
Are you still Catholic?
I'm not. I'm not Catholic. I honor the faith. I honor when people choose it, but it doesn't work for me anymore. I have a very active spiritual life, and it's just extremely important to me. But it's more about meditation and Kundalini yoga, and that's really what I practice.
Well, meditation is a big part of life in Fairfield for a number of us because it's the center of the Transcendental Meditation movement.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Lucky you.
Yeah. Yep. So how long did you spend writing this?
It took me about 5 or 6 years.
About 5 or 6 years. And did you plan on publishing from the very beginning?
I did not. I started with my husband, at the time, bought me a box.
Your husband, that's great. I've never heard that before.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a chapter in it in my next book. So I would write on sticky notes, and I'd have a memory, and I'd write it on a sticky note, and apparently I was leaving them all over the house, and he bought me this beautiful linen box, and he said, just start putting them in here. And he bought me these beautiful cardstock cards. And so I started writing, and I would just throw them in there because I was kind of afraid, you know, and the box started filling up, and I realized I really have to tell my story. I was really scared because I had never written anything in my life, and I was terrified to call myself a writer. But after a while, I realized that it was a craft that I really loved, and it was very cathartic and healing and hopefully transformative for other people.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Kiel Bergen, author of Holy Unraveled. Kiel, tell me a little bit about your company.
Oh, Bee Tribes. I love it so much, and it's such a pleasure that I get to watch these women change. Basically, what we do is curate tribes of women, 12 to a tribe, and we take them through a 6-month curriculum where it's all about relieving the things that don't serve you anymore, just getting them gone, the patterns and the fears that we unconsciously and consciously live with. We identify those and we get rid of them. And we do it while we hold each other in kind of a sacred circle with a lot of love and accountability and coaching and partnerships and mentoring. And it's been the most incredible thing to watch these women change over the 6 months and to really stand in their own power, to understand that one of the major tenets of Bee Tribes is that we are all the teacher and we are all the student, and we can't forget that. We can't just, you know, we have so much wisdom, the collective wisdom, and we share that with each other as women, and it's so beautiful.
And how long have you been doing this?
I've been doing it for about a year now, and I start 2 more groups in January, and it's a really unique curriculum that I've come up with, and it's about relationships within the tribe and the relationships that you carry outside of it. And it really changes the trajectory of women's lives and opens them to move along their own unique path with their own worth and their own direction and accountability.
Well, how do you put together a tribe?
Well, it's really amazing. I mean, the one that just finished, they just come from all over. It's really beautiful. It's people who have read my book, or it's people who I have a friend of a friend in California. I mean, I have people who, the last tribe, there was someone from the UK, there was someone from California, there was someone from Atlanta, there was someone from New Jersey, there was someone from Boulder, where I live, and they just, it's like they know it's time to change their life or to change something in their life, and they find Bee Tribes.
And what was your previous company that you took public?
I did a strategic marketing company, and we did analytics and online strategy and back in the day. And it was an amazing ride. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing, but apparently I did, because it was, but I feel like I got my doctorate in business just figuring that out. You know, it was really, it was back in the internet boom days, and it was so much fun. We got acquired, we went public. I was able to work with some incredible brands, you know, Nike and Universal Studios, and I worked with Richard Branson and Shaquille O'Neal. It was really a fun time.
So when Holy Unraveled ends, which personally I feel like it ends a little too soon, because you're just leaving Madonna House and you're starting your path to your future, but I want to know what happens next. So how did you get from there to here?
Yeah, well, a lot of hard work and a lot of fun along the way too. But there's a lot more to say. I mean, I kid sometimes and say, I have like 5 more books in me. So I guess you might have to wait and see the next book.
but
it's important.
I mean, you're leaving Madonna House with basically the clothes on your back, right?
Correct. Yes. I left with the clothes on my back. I went to upstate New York for a little while. It wasn't my town. And so I moved to Denver, Colorado, and I started work. I just got a job and got an apartment and started living. And it was fantastic to finally have that sense of worthiness. So I knew I belonged in the world for the first time, really.
And yet you were totally on your own at that point.
Yes, I was completely on my own. Wow. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that just seems like it would take such amazing courage. I've never really struck out completely on my own. I mean, I've done a lot, believe me, but
yeah.
I've always had somebody else there. Partly because I had my son when I was 18, so it's hard to be alone when you have kids.
Oh, but... yeah, of course. Yeah. Oh, that's great. No, I think we're all, that's the other takeaway I hope that people get, is that we are all very resilient and worthy. And there is so much happiness to be had after, whether it's trauma or abuse or neglect or whatever it is that is your part of your story, say it and release yourself from that. I mean, I was so interested in what I wanted to know, like my mother's story and my father's story and my grandmother's story, and I never got to hear their stories. And so I think it's so important for us to be telling our stories.
Well, Keel, we have just a few minutes left. Do you want to read a little more?
Sure, I'd love to. Let's see. Well, given that I was just talking about stories, I'll read a little bit about my grandmother, because she was hospitalized for 7 years, and they did shock treatments and things on her. And when she came out, she was never the same. And I wanted her to tell me about her, but she never would. I'll read you that.
Okay.
I would hide behind, when she came to visit, I would hide somewhere and watch her. So this is one of those times. I hid behind the sheer white curtains by the twin brass beds to watch her. I wondered why grandmother wanted to stay in here instead of in one of the other guest rooms on the third floor with the Egyptian cotton sheets, cashmere blankets, and clawfoot soaker tubs. Maybe she didn't want to be alone, or maybe it was because Maggie's room was closer to the stairs, meaning she could get out quick if something went wrong. I always had so many questions for her when she came to visit, but I never asked them. I watched her narrow face and frightened blue eyes staring into the mirror above the antique sink. She squinted and looked closely at herself, then took one step backward and looked into the mirror again. Her eyes shone brighter, and I heard her exhale. She was smiling into the mirror. Her face dropped the tension, and her pursed lips relaxed into a true smile. Her body looked lucid and vulnerable as she stopped just shy of a curtsy. She stepped forward again, close to the mirror, and pulled a porcelain bowl from her bag and set it by the sink. She wore a wig. It was all teased up like a hive to keep others from getting into her head. She was aware that we knew she wore it, but there was some weird code of silence around the wig, as if it kept all of her secrets. And if you asked about it, it would instantly turn into a swarm of bees large enough to kill you. I pulled the curtains to the side of my body and watched her take it off. She started from the back and released the set number of bobby pins as if they were her friends. She held each one of them for more than a second and counted them individually before putting them into the white porcelain bowl next to Maggie's sink. She pulled the wig off and stood perfectly still as she stared into the mirror. Her natural hair was flat against her head, and she moved both hands to touch her hair, which was still pinned up with more bobby pins. When the last bobby pin was laid to rest in the porcelain bowl, I could see her as she'd been in her youth. Her natural hair underneath that godforsaken wig was like a silk carpet that was unwrapped from its packaging. Her long, white, gray hair trailed behind her like a novel, one I would never have the privilege of reading, because she would not publish it. Oh, what I would do to get my hands on that book. It would have explained something to me, given me a reason for my lack of mothering. It would have given me empathy and a place to go when I desperately needed to understand why I didn't get a mother of plenty, just a mother of sorts.
Yeah, it's hard to learn to be a mother when you weren't mothered yourself. You had children.
Right.
And how did you break that cycle?
I broke it because I was so purposeful about how I raised them. They are allowed to talk. They have a voice. They have their own journey. They know that they are loved unconditionally. And I treat them as people, you know, age appropriately, but I talk to them about the world and what's going on. And we have beautiful questions that we ask each other. And they know about my childhood. They don't know all the details, but I've told them they can read the book when they're 18. And I have a 19-year-old now who has no interest in reading it, which is great. and we'll see what happens when my 13-year-old, get to be 18. We'll see.
Well, we're out of time. And I just want to tell you that I really enjoyed talking to you today, and I'm want to congratulate you on how the path that you took and your willingness to share it, to share the pain, to help others.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, and I know it can't be easy, and I can see why you don't. You're just as happy that your son does, or. Well, you said a 19-year-old. I don't know if you said a son, but that your 19-year-old doesn't want to read it. But do you ever read it? Or once it was done, was it like, I don't ever want to visit this again?
No, I'm absolutely – it's part of me. It's my story, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of overcoming that level of adversity, and I'm so privileged to be out talking to people and hearing their stories. And hearing, you know, you told yours, maybe I can tell mine. And I'm like, yes, you can.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. And I'm going to finish up with a quote from Maya Angelou.
Ooh.
You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them.
Beautiful. I'm reading her book again right now.
And I think that fits very well with the lesson from your book too.
Thank you.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.